Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day. Hello and welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Napolitano. And before we begin, I just want to remind you, if you're enjoying the podcast and you can spare the time, you can give us a 5-star rating on iTunes or a review. And you can also follow us on Twitter at The Badlands Pod and check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/TheBadlandsPod. All of those things help people discover the podcast, which in turn will help us get amazing guests onto the show like the one we have today. So one of the aims of the podcast is to sketch out in a bit more detail some of the philosophical foundations of progressive politics. And one such foundation that has been a focus of the series thus far is a deep commitment to human rights. In fact, I think it's fair to say that one of the things that sets progressivism apart from other contemporary political ideologies is this deep commitment to a really robust set of human rights. But while appeals to human rights have become increasingly common in our political discourse, there isn't much discussion about what human rights are, nor are there justifications given for the idea that we even have such things in the first place. And a healthy intellectual curiosity should make us wonder about these things, especially since their recognition is a fairly recent phenomenon, and there are still lots of open questions in the philosophical literature on human rights that are the subject of ongoing investigation. As it so happens, we have one of the leading scholars on the philosophy of human rights with us today, Susie Kilmister, to talk more about these questions. Welcome, Susie, and thanks for joining us on the Badlands.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
And for those who don't know, Susie is currently a lecturer in philosophy at Monash University in Australia. She's written and published on the topics of human rights, human dignity, and autonomy. And she's currently working on a book, the working title of which is Contours of Dignity. And I also have to say that Susie's been very influential in my own thinking on human rights. And I had the good fortune of being a graduate student at the University of Connecticut while she was an assistant professor there. So it's a special pleasure to have you on the podcast, Susie.
Thanks.
Okay, so before we get to the serious stuff, I just have to ask you, I was going through your academic profile online, and under the activities section, there's an item called stand-up philosophy. and the description is performance as part of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. So please tell me that you have a philosophical comedy stand-up routine that you delivered there.
I don't, but that was a really interesting experience. I was invited to do this event and I was assured by the organizer that it was like philosophy and stand-up. So the idea was that you'd have a philosopher talking about philosophy stuff and they'd be followed by a stand-up comedian. All these assurances like, don't worry, you don't have to be funny. No one's expecting you to be funny. For the love of God, don't try to make a joke. So I was like, okay, I can do that. And then about a week before the event, I had a look at the Facebook page about how they were advertising the event. And it was something like, you know, come along to this side-splitting comedy event, the philosophers will have you in stitches type stuff. Like, oh my God, he's advertising us as comedians. So I did, in fact, attempt something.
Oh, yes.
Philosophy. And got a couple of laughs. I gather it wasn't so, people told me it was pretty good,
Can we have, you know, one of your best bits, or you could say that for a future episode if you want. We can, you know, we'll do a whole Susie Kilmister comedy special.
I can't remember my jokes. I don't think I had jokes per se, but I just tried to be kind of, yeah, generally funny, but it was about sex bots. So there was material.
There is material there. That's
it wasn't so bad. But I got to say, I've done a lot of like lecturing over the years, and I got no problem standing up in front of a room of like 400 bored 18-year-olds. That's fine.
Yep.
But my God, getting on stage with like bright lights and drunk people expecting you to be funny has got to be one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. Thanks for reminding me of that.
Well, if you actually got some laughs, I think you're probably one of the few philosophers in the field who can actually.
It helps if your audience is drunk. It turns out
that's fair. All right. Well, why don't we transition to the serious stuff now?
Sure.
The human rights stuff. So why don't
it
we just?
Funny, so, yeah.
So why don't we just start with the basics? What are human rights, and what do they do for us? Or to put it another way, what is it about these rights that makes them human rights, and what's the importance of their being rights as opposed to some other kind of moral entity?
Sure. So I think it's probably easiest just to start with what rights are and then think about what makes human rights a kind of special kind of right. So the most important thing, I guess, to get clear on is that there's a really important difference between something being good or something being right in the kind of colloquial sense and something's being a right. So when we talk of something being a right, what we really mean is that someone's entitled to something. They have a kind of moral claim to it. It's not just good if it's done for them or if things aren't done to them, but they actually have an entitlement that that thing is provided or that this certain thing isn't done to them. And crucially, what this means is that when we're talking about rights, we're also talking about there having to be some kind of corresponding duties. So if you have a right to something, there's got to be at least one other person or groups of people or organizations, whatever it is, who has a duty either to provide you with something or to kind of not do something to you. So I think a simple example helps kind of make this clear. So imagine that you and I are down the pub. I've forgotten my purse because that's the kind of thing I always do. You're a nice guy, so I ask you to buy me a beer. It would be a good thing for you to buy me a beer, trust me. I'm a moral philosopher, I'm telling you, it'd be a good thing for you to buy me a beer. It might even be the right thing to do, but I don't have a right to that beer, right? And you don't have a moral obligation to buy me a beer, right? So it's a good thing to do, but it's not a right. It's not the kind of thing that we would say I have a right to. But we compare this to a case where you lend me, say, $10. Now you have a right, okay? So you're entitled to having that money back and I have a moral obligation to give it to you, right? So you don't have to ask me nicely. It's not up to me whether or not I give that money back to you, right? So you have this kind of power, moral power. I mean, you can't physically force me, but you have this moral power, a kind of entitlement that I now can give that money back and I have this kind of corresponding duty to give this money back to you, right? So when we're talking about rights, it's more than just a good thing to do. It's something that you've kind of got this standing, this moral standing to demand from other people. So that's rights in general. And then when we're talking about human rights, we're talking about a special kind of right. The most, I guess, important aspect that differentiates human rights from other kind of rights is that human rights are meant to be the rights that every human being has just in virtue of being human. Right, so you don't have to be rich, you don't have to belong to a particular nation, you don't have to be a good person. Right? Every human being is supposed to have human rights. The second key feature of human rights is that they're supposed to be inalienable, so you can't lose them. This ends up being really important if we're thinking about things like a human right to freedom from torture. That no matter what you've done, the idea is meant to be that if there's a human right to freedom from torture, you don't give that up just because you've committed even an atrocious crime, right? You still have that human right. Finally, and this gets a little bit more contentious, human rights are meant to pick out really important kind of matters. They're meant to set this kind of minimum threshold below which people aren't supposed to fall. So just to kind of explain what I mean there, a case could be made that every human being has a right that other people don't just stand on their feet, right? Like someone stands on their feet on a subway, right? They have violated your right. They've got an obligation not to do that, at least not to do it deliberately. But it would be really kind of ridiculous to say you violated my human right because you deliberately stood on my foot, right? Or you pinched me or something like that. So we typically use human rights to talk about the most important kind of goods that people ought to be provided with or harms that people ought to be prevented from suffering. So essentially then when we're talking about human rights, we're talking about rights that are universal, they're inalienable, and they're to these kind of basic goods or the avoidance of significant harms. That's the kind of basic idea of human rights. And remember, they're not just good things, they're things that we're supposed to be able to demand, right? Others owe it to us not to violate our rights. We're not talking about charity. We're not talking about doing good deeds here. We're talking about things that you're actually entitled to, that you've got a claim to.
So one thing that's noteworthy about human rights is that they've only really gained widespread recognition very recently in human history. Can you just briefly sketch for us some of the history of the modern conception of human rights and maybe gesture at the ways that conception has expanded over time?
Sure. Again, we're talking about philosophy, so everything is contentious. There is a bit of contention around the history of even the modern conception, but I'll give you the kind of general story that we tell ourselves generally in academic
Perfect.
Philosophy and I think in a lot of academic history as well. So the kind of standard story is that the modern conception of human rights was more or less born with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. And then the idea is that moment in history of the nations of the world coming together to endorse this document laying out these important rights, that was a response to the horrors of World War II, a kind of moment of we can't let this happen again, in a sense making this commitment, global commitment to these being the things that every human being ought to be entitled to, and we have this kind of collective agreement that we'll work towards a world in which these rights are satisfied. So that's the kind of the story. but even within that story, there's acknowledgement that the Universal Declaration didn't kind of come out of nowhere. People didn't just sit down and make these rights up because things they happened to think were important on the day. The Universal Declaration builds on earlier kinds of documents that had been in circulation. So we can think, for instance, of the US Bill of Rights. We can think of things like the French Declaration of the Rights of Man as earlier examples of documents that look quite similar in content in some places to the Universal Declaration. But those earlier documents played a kind of different political role. Even though they often used this quite, well, I was going to say universal language, the language of things like all men are created equal, which obviously is not fully universal, but still it had these kind of claims to universality in some sense. They were still really intended as national documents. So they were laying out the rights of citizens, right, rather than necessarily the rights of individuals wherever they happen to be in the world. So that's meant to be one of the kind of key shifts with the modern conception, is that we kind of move rights out of the national domain and we put them into the international domain. So it's no longer just about the relationship between you and your state and your state leaders, but about the global community being this kind of backup. If your state fails to uphold your rights, you've kind of got this other place you can go, at least in theory, to demand that your rights are met. So there's this shift from the rights of citizens to the rights of human beings as such. And another kind of difference, if we're thinking about the kind of history, or at least the mythology of the history, is that the kind of content of human rights has evolved somewhat too. So human rights theorists will often talk about what they call three generations of rights. The first generation picks out civil and political rights. So these are the rights that I think are probably most familiar in the US context, the ones that have got the most buy-in.
Yes.
if anything's got buy-in across the political spectrum in the US, it's civil and political rights.
Yep.
Even that's maybe a bit of a stretch these days, but the idea of things like a right to trial, a right to vote, like even as I'm enunciating them, maybe yeah. the universality of these, maybe.
We're trying.
You try. Rights to freedom from torture, the kind of protecting the body from harm, and basic kinds of political entitlements, like the right to vote. So these are kind of the first, we might think, rights that got global buy-in. The second generation of rights, which we already see in the Universal Declaration, are the socioeconomic rights. So these are rights to be provided with certain kinds of goods. So the right to an education would be a social and economic right. A right to welfare, a right to healthcare, those kinds of things. And the key difference is basically, it's a bit of simplistic difference, it doesn't always work, but the basic difference is meant to be civil and political rights you can basically have satisfied if the government more or less leaves you alone.
Uh-huh.
That's why they get more buy-in in the US. And the social economic rights are the kind of things that have to be provided for you, which is what makes them a little bit more contentious. But like I said, we already see those in the Universal Declaration, but they have been historically a more recent kind of idea that states have this obligation to provide these goods for individuals. And then the third generation, which is much more recent, much more contentious, still, I think, not at the level of acceptance that we get for the first two generations, are collective and cultural rights. So we might think of a right to a clean environment would be one, a right to national self-determination often gets put in this class, or rights that minority groups might have, say Indigenous rights or rights of linguistic minorities. That would fall in this last class. And you still get a lot of people who say, look, they might be important, but they're not really human rights. They're still a bit, it's early days, I'd say, for those kinds of rights.
Okay, great. That's an excellent primer on just a sort of quick sketch of what human rights are and a little bit of the history of the, or the the mythology of the history of the modern. Especially, I need to hear more about that because I'm not sure I know more than the mythology myself. But so a lot of your work is focused on the foundations of human rights, which would tell us about whether we actually have human rights at all, and if so, what it is about us that grounds these rights. And I actually think these questions are really important because, given the history you just described, you could imagine someone responding reasonably, even with some skepticism, right? They might think that human rights are, just to put it bluntly, made up, right? They're really just political fabrications designed to further certain political ends. If one agrees with those political ends, then that's fine. But if someone doesn't agree with those political ends in the first place, you know, maybe they think torture is very often justified, for example, then it's not clear why they should care about appeals to human rights. Or just to put it another way, appeals to human rights are typically used to justify certain political ends. But if they're just political fabrications, it's hard to see how they can do that. So generally speaking, what are the kinds of approaches that philosophers take with respect to the foundations of human rights? Like, what kinds of justifications can be given for thinking that we actually have such things?
Excellent. So I think you've really put your finger on what motivates a lot of the philosophical work on human rights, this desire to kind of make human rights or put human rights beyond political contestation, right? To take them out of that kind of hurly-burly of left versus right and say, look, these are just things that are eternal, they're unchanging, right? They don't change because of the way we think about them or whether or not we agree with them. These are standards that we're all held to no matter what. And there's this real desire, I think, to vindicate this picture of human rights. The way philosophers have traditionally gone about doing that, what typically gets called the orthodox approach or the natural rights view, basically starts from the really basic insight that we have human rights because we're human, right? This was what was supposed to set human rights apart from other kinds of rights. But if we have human rights because we're human, we should be able to point to something about human beings that explains why we have rights, why we have human rights. Historically, that's often been done with a kind of religious justification, right? And this is actually a lot easier, right? Mm-hmm. If you kind of buy into the religious worldview, you've kind of got the answer solved, right? So humans are created in the image of God. We're special. God endowed us with reason and free will and these kinds of things. This makes us different from other animals. And now here we go, we're off to the races. We're special. God made us special. We have human rights. Contemporary philosophers would like to find a foundation for human rights that doesn't depend on belief in the existence of God. We're meant to take human rights out of contestation here, and we're not going to do that if we appeal to God. So the typical strategy is to try to look for some kind of natural feature, right? Something that is identifiable and makes sense within a scientific worldview. So a kind of intrinsic feature or capacity of human beings that makes us special. But they only kind of drift so far, I think, from these earlier religious views, because what they tend to focus on is the same kind of features that the religious views talked about. So being endowed with reason, being endowed with free will, there's that kind of picture kind of gets smuggled in there. But that is in general the idea. We're meant to pick out some kind of natural feature or capacity of human beings. It's meant to be morally significant, and so it needs to be protected, and this is why we have human rights. That kind of way of thinking about human rights has been getting a fair bit of pushback in the last 10 or 20 years within philosophical circles. So there are a number of philosophers who are skeptical of that kind of project of identifying this special something about human beings and then kind of building the human rights edifice on that basis. So the skeptics will say we don't need such foundations, or they might even say that the search for these foundations, attempting to put human rights on these foundations, is counterproductive, is kind of dangerous. Mm. What they say is that we should think about human rights not as this thing that kind of stands outside politics, this kind of eternal, unchanging, natural, moral entity, but instead as actually a kind of recent historical phenomenon, a political phenomenon, a kind of global political practice, you might say, that has lots of different components to it. We've got the kind of things like treaties and conventions and covenants, what we might think of as kind of law, whether hard law or soft law. We've also got the kind of activities of things like NGOs who work within a human rights kind of framework, and a general kind of, we might call, discourse of human rights, right? The language of human rights has become a tool in things like diplomacy. So we've got this kind of practice. And these skeptical philosophers will say, look, we can think about this practice on its own terms. It's got nothing to do with this kind of foundational project the philosophers, these other philosophers are talking about. So we see it as a political practice that we justify as a political practice, not as this eternal, unchanging kind of moral reality outside
right.
kind of mess of politics.
Okay, so can you say a little bit more about the orthodox view that you sketched out here, the kind of natural rights view, which says there's something inherent about human beings, some natural property of them, something about the kinds of creatures we are that makes it the case that we have these human rights? Maybe you could you give some examples of this kind of approach?
Yeah, sure. So I hinted at this earlier when I said that, at least on my view, these foundational approaches, the orthodox approach, don't actually get as far from the religious views as they sometimes like to think that they do. And I think, at least in my kind of reading of this, a lot of the influence of this orthodox approach comes from Immanuel Kant, as always in philosophy. Mm. We can always trace it back to Kant. We can always blame it on Kant. But his idea, I think, has been itself influenced by this religious tradition, even while it's trying to distance itself from that religious tradition. And then that, in turn, I think, has ended up, I was going to use the word infected, but that might be a bit loaded.
I wonder which side you're on.
its influence is still visible, I think, in orthodox approaches today. And so the idea, Kant's basic idea, is that what makes human beings special, what sets us apart, what makes it the case that other people have duties towards us, is that we have moral autonomy, right, which is a kind of rationality, a kind of freedom to choose the kind of life we want to lead. In Kant's picture, the freedom to choose to do good or not, to kind of follow the moral law or not. Modern conceptions of human rights will often drop the moral language, so it's not so much about whether the fact that we get to choose whether or not to do good or bad, but just this more general picture of human beings as a kind of creatures that can envision a future for ourselves, can choose a pathway through life, can think about, step back and reflect on what kind of person we want to be. So the idea is meant to be that, look, you've got non-human animals. It's a really simplistic picture. Non-human animals, they all act on the basis of instinct, right? A dog doesn't, it might choose whether or not to gnaw the bone, but it can't reflect on whether it wants to be the kind of creature that gnaws on bones, right? That's the kind of picture. And then human beings are meant to be the kind of creatures that, like, we have these urges and we have these desires and sometimes we act on them, maybe even against our better judgment. But we're also the kind of creatures that step back and think, do I want to be the kind of person that does that? What kind of person do I want to be? Do I want to act on my instinct or do I not? And that's meant to set us apart, meant to make us special. And so these are the kind, that's, I think, the most common feature that philosophers will point to, this ability to choose a path through life, this kind of reflectiveness about our own lives mm-hmm. that human beings are supposed to have.
And because of this ability, then we have these special rights that other kinds of creatures don't have. Unless, I guess one thing this points to is that it's not as obviously about being a human being, but possessing this kind of capacity, which in principle other things could possess.
Absolutely. And if you watch the HBO series Westworld, I really like this as a, it's a bit graphic to show my undergraduate students. hard to find clips that are appropriate, but I think that's one of these kind of dominant parts of the narrative there, is this question of, do these creatures have the kinds of capacities that would give them these inherent rights, right? Are they in fact able to do this reflecting? Are they just on a program? Because if they're on a program, they don't have the rights. But if they're governing themselves, then the idea is meant to be, then it's something deeply, deeply wrong about what's being done to them. So that idea that we, in a sense, could create, or maybe there's already out there, you know, if we think about something like alien life, or maybe we'll learn things about dolphins, right? We don't know. It leaves it open that if there are other creatures that have these kind of capacities, well, then they get in the kind of human rights family, right? The human rights have to be extended to them too.
Having read your work, I know that this leads to a criticism that you have of the orthodox view. Do you want to just go ahead and explain that?
I think that, first to say that I think the real value of the orthodox approach is in this openness it has to human rights extending beyond members of the human species. I don't think we should rule that out off the bat. But I do think it has this kind of flip side problem, which is that you don't automatically get in just because you're a human being. And so if we say that in order to have human rights, in order to qualify for human rights, you have to be the kind of creature that is able to reflect on its own desires, is able to have this kind of critical analysis of its own life. There are a lot of human beings who don't have that, right? We can think about infants, don't have that. And people with significant cognitive impairments, as far as we know, don't have that. And what you actually find is that, you know, philosophers like to be consistent. The whole point is to follow an argument where it goes. And so you will get philosophers who will say, well, we have human rights because we have human rights because we're rational or autonomous. If there are human beings that aren't rational or autonomous, they just don't have human rights. And I think that's a step too far. That's a bridge I'm not willing to cross. If that's what we end up saying about human rights, I think we need to find another story. I guess this is an area in my own work where I get misunderstood a lot. So I'm going to take the opportunity to forestall.
Okay, you heard it here first, listeners.
I do think autonomy is important. I think the things that the orthodox approach is pointing to are important, and I think they're morally significant, and they can ground what an orthodox approach is going to call natural rights. I don't really have a beef with that idea. I just don't think that that exhausts all that human rights can be. So in my own work, I try to think about not necessarily an alternative foundation, but a supplementary foundation. Is there another pathway to justify human rights that can kind of sit beside this other view and that can extend out to all human beings as well? Right? So maybe you can have human rights because you're autonomous, but you can also have human rights for this other kind of reason too. That's the kind of picture I want to kind of draw.
And so I guess just to clarify, for people who do hold some version of the orthodox view, and you know, they might end up saying that infants, strictly speaking, don't have human rights, or the severely cognitively impaired don't have human rights, they will say, just to clarify for people, they of course will say that that doesn't mean that it would be okay to harm them or something like that. Just to be clear, this is just about whether they have these special kinds of rights. But one of the things that motivates you, though, is this idea that we started with in the beginning, that it's something that all human beings have. Yeah. So the listener may get the sense that you do not take the orthodox approach. So you take the institutional approach instead, which means that on your view, broadly speaking, human rights are socially constructed. That's the kind of approach you take. But so what is your answer to the question, what is it about us that makes it the case that we have these human rights? Just lay out your whole theory right here.
I'll try to be brief. So one thing that I should note is that on a lot of institutional approaches, they'll just reject the question, right? They'll just say we don't need to say what it is about us that makes it the case that we have human rights, right? Human rights play this role in global politics. A common thing people point to is that human rights are the things that place limits on sovereignty. So if human rights are violated, that is what makes it okay for some kind of intervention from one state into another. And then the thought is that we don't have to say anything about what it means to be human to answer that question. I don't think that's right. I think if you start asking, like, well, when can other states intervene and why can they intervene? We just end up back at this question. We can't escape it. So I think we do. I just think I owe you an answer to that question. And you're right that I reject the orthodoxy and I take a kind of institutional social constructive view, which might make it sound like, well, there's nothing you can really say here about if human rights are socially constructed and we don't think they're based on what it means to be human, how are we supposed to go forward? So here's the kind of strategy I adopt. So I think there's something really to this basic insight that we have human rights because we're human. But I think where the orthodox approach goes wrong is to think that what matters about humans is some kind of intrinsic natural property. This is what leads you down to this kind of exclusionary path of saying, well, it's not actually about being human. It's about having these other capacities. And so robots are in and infants are out.
Whatever property or capacity you pick, you're going to have human beings that, just as a matter of fact, are going to lack that thing.
Whatever capacity. I mean, look, you could find something that all human beings have. It's, you know, there are things, but then it's really hard to explain how you get human rights out of them, right? So like sensitivity to pain, sure, we all in some sense have sensitivity to pain, but so do all living creatures. And most people don't want to say, therefore, they all have like the full suite of human rights. So there's things that we could say, but if we want them to actually have some moral force, I think we're pushed into this kind of exclusionary path. But I think there's another way of thinking about what it means to be human. I guess that's the easiest way to explain what I'm doing, where I want to think of the human, or I do think of the human, as not just a biological category, but as also a socially constructed category. So on my view, human functions something like citizenship or royalty, these kind of social kinds that are just transparently constructed. There's no royalty in nature. Once upon a time we thought that royalty were kind of descended from the gods, and so people were royals kind of irrespective of what other people did. But now I think we recognize that, like, no, we made royals. We made them special. We gave them a certain kind of role. We granted them certain privileges. There are things they're entitled to that us mere civilians aren't. And so my picture, humans kind of like that, right? Once upon a time, we thought that there was this special thing that God gave us. And if people still believe that, I think that's fair enough. But I think we don't need to believe in the kind of religious story to think of the human as something kind of special, right? That just like royalty, we can continue, in a sense, with this social category, even once we've kind of lost the origin story that we once had. Another way I've been thinking about this kind of recently, it's try not to derail this because it's an example that's difficult in its own right, but if we think about the way feminists have traditionally thought about the sex-gender distinction, right? So there's this idea that there's this biological thing, sex. Again, contentious, I know. It's too simplistic. But if we take the simplistic story, there's this biological thing, sex. But really where all the work's at is at the socially constructed category of gender, right? So what makes it the case that people are oppressed and some people are privileged and that people occupy certain roles and not others? Most of that can't be explained by looking at the biological stuff. We have to look at the socially constructed category of gender to see what's going on. And so my idea of the human's a bit like that. Sure, there's a biological thing under here, absolutely. But most of the work, almost all the work, is actually done with this socially constructed category, these kind of layers of cultural meaning that have come to apply to being human. And that gets you the kind of, it gets you the conclusion that all human beings have human rights, because we're all part of this socially constructed category. That's part of the meaning of that category, is that all human beings are in it. Also, all members of the species are kind of in it. But the kind of what it means to be human, why we're owed certain things, on my view, doesn't come out of the biological, at least not directly, but is a kind of, is part of this social construct, part of this meaning that we've given to the human.
We're finally extending some of the benefits that were only conferred on royalty to a broader social category.
Yeah, absolutely. And this, I mean, I kind of borrow this idea and extend this idea from the philosopher Jeremy Waldron, who's got this idea of, he puts it in terms of dignity, but dignity is rank, where he said, look, dignity used to be the kind of thing that only the kind of higher echelons of society had. What it means to have dignity is to be entitled to certain things, to have a certain set of rights. And now we've just leveled everybody up. Right now, everyone's royalty, in a sense, right? Mm. Everyone's entitled to the kinds of goods that only royalty used to be entitled to.
Okay, so the appeal to the difference between sex, at least on one understanding, and gender, I think was really helpful. One is taken to be a kind of natural biological category. The other one is a kind of social category. So to be a man or to be a woman or whatever is to have a particular social status. Mm. Now, in the case of human, it's slightly more complicated, I guess, in that we have one term for kind of both. There's kind of the biological sense of human, but then there's also, as you're saying, it also denotes a social category, being a human. So can you maybe say a little bit more about that?
So one thing to note is that it's actually quite recent that we have two terms for sex and gender. And part of why I think we have two terms is that we kind of, in a sense, saw this potential difference and so gave words to it. But I think there are other examples we can think of where there's pretty clearly a kind of biological kind and a social kind in use, in going to play a role in our world, and we just use the same term for each and we just disambiguate with context. So we can think about something like parent, for instance, which in some context is a biological kind. It's about standing in a certain kind of reproductive relationship to someone. But of course we have adoptive parents, right? We have guardians, we have those kind of things who in most contexts we'll call parents. So we have a biological kind and then we have a social kind that's kind of adopted the same terminology but has a broader kind of, I guess, entrance criteria would be one way to put it, right? More people count as the social kind parent than as a biological kind parent. And there, I guess, there are some people who are biological kind parents who aren't social kind parent too. So they kind of come apart. But we do have this in other kind of cases where there's the same term, sometimes picking out biological and sometimes picking out a socially constructed one.
Okay, so what about the social construction process itself? So I'm thinking about the analogy to laws, right? Laws are sort of paradigmatically socially constructed, and I think people have a pretty good grasp on how that happens. But how does social construction work in the human rights case? And as a follow-up, right, laws tend to be localized to varying degrees. It could be local or state or, you know, national, whatever. But human rights are different in that they purport to be universal. So how can that work?
That's a big question, Toby, but I'll see what I can do with it. So in my view, probably easiest to start with the idea that the human's socially constructed and then think about how human rights kind of fit into that picture, what role they play. So again, I think the analogy with gender can kind of help here, that part of how categories like woman, I think, get constructed and maintained is about social norms, right? And it's a lot harder when we're talking about categories like woman that aren't kind of legally, not fully legally instantiated, right? If we're thinking about something like citizen, it's easy, right? There's rules, there's laws, yep. right? And so yep. so we can see how the categories like citizen are constructed. But when we're thinking about these more ephemeral kind of kinds, we have to think about how norms kind of get generated. And I don't have a good story for that, but I do think we can just think a bit more generally about the ways in which we collectively end up treating people. So the idea here is that in some sense, for whatever reason, people tend to internalize kind of principles or rules about who counts as a woman and who doesn't. And I think we can say the same thing about the human too, right? We have these kind of rules about who counts as a member of this special kind, who has this certain kind of status. But more importantly, I think we also internalize kinds of rules about how members of a certain category ought to be treated. Right. This is part of how something like the category of woman operates, is that stick to a particular kind of community for now, to keep things simple. Mm-hmm. Right? Within a particular community, there are both implicit and explicit kind of norms about what it means to be a woman, who counts as a woman, and how women ought to be treated. We can't always, I think, articulate those, but there's this sense of like women will get kind of disciplined, right, if they do the wrong thing, if they don't act like women ought to act, and people will get kind of disciplined if they don't treat women the way in which women, in some sense, kind of with scare quotes around it, ought to be treated. And I think that we can tell the same kind of story here with human, right, that there's this internalized kinds of norms about how humans ought to be treated because they're human, right? You're the right kind of thing to be treated in this way. You're doing something wrong if you treat things like this in this other way. Now, there is a story that I guess I fudged a little bit before about, well, where do these norms kind of come from? How do they come about? I think when we're thinking about the human, at least as I'm thinking about the human, there's a few things that we can kind of point to here. And for me, actually, human rights themselves play a pretty central role here. So the idea is that part of what the human rights practice does, both in the kind of treaties and conventions that get explicitly written down and then adopted and then become part of international law, and in more general kind of the work that NGOs do and the kind of discourse around human rights, the part of what that's doing is kind of articulating these norms about how humans ought to be treated because they're human. And that just kind of builds in and reinforces this category, this social category of the human, kind of in some sense makes it the case. There's this kind of, there is this perhaps slightly weird circularity in my kind of view. Human rights is part of the process that makes it the case that we're humans and hence kind of have human rights. Mm. I don't think human rights practice is a whole story. I think we can look at things like global media and the way global media represents certain things as tragedies or represents certain things as horrors, atrocities that ought not to happen, is part of telling these kind of stories, I think, helps internalize these norms about this thing's a this creature is a human, and because they're a human, they oughtn't to be treated in these ways. So that's a kind of picture about, I think, how social categories kind of operate and get maintained. That's the kind of idea there. You did also raise this, I think, looming problem about universality.
Only because you raise it in your own writing.
No, I know. It's a problem, and I recognize it's a problem on my account. But I think it's a problem in the sense that it identifies something true about human rights practice, that it's a problem for human rights practice rather than, in a sense, for the theory, right? I'm not looking for a theory that makes human rights uncriticizable or a kind of unmitigated good in the world. I think it's important to be sensitive to the ways in which, while human rights might be overall good, there's these kind of worries that we ought to be aware of, where human rights might not be all good. And here's, and this is it, precisely one of those areas, because I don't think that there is any kind of universally agreed upon conception of the human. I don't think all humans everywhere could agree on some kind of full, complete list of, like, here's what it means to be human and here's how humans ought to be treated. So part of what I think human rights practice actually does is impose this idea of the human on people who wouldn't necessarily otherwise accept it. Right? So I do think that's a kind of cost to human rights. But I don't think that cost is prohibitive. And one of the reasons I think that comes back to this idea I kind of opened with, that when we're talking about human rights, we're talking about a bare minimum. Right? Human rights aren't meant to set out every single thing that human beings are entitled to. They're meant to set this kind of threshold below which human beings ought not to fall. So on my kind of picture, we get, when I talk about the human, I'm talking about quite a kind of thin idea, or at least the human relevant to human rights is quite a kind of thin idea. It doesn't have a huge amount of content. It's really picking out these kind of bare minimums. That's what I think is kind of global. But I think that's compatible with there being kind of local versions, in some sense you might think of local versions of the human, where different communities that just have different ideas about how humans ought to be treated. And that can be kind of a richer notion. There might be more that people are entitled to that aren't covered by human rights. So you get this kind of double layer, the kind of very thin threshold stuff for human rights, this kind of global picture of the bare minimum for the human, and then gets cashed out in local ways.
Can you maybe just give a really quick example, just so people are clear about the kinds of differences you might be talking about?
So take the list in the Universal Declaration. That's part of what I see as this kind of global picture of what human beings are entitled to. So freedom from torture, right to a basic education, those kind of things. This isn't to say that I think everyone in the world agrees to these things. I don't want to make that. But just that insofar as there's a kind of a global norm which has kind of power, that's the part of the content of that. But then we could think about things like how people ought to be treated after they die would be an example of one where there's huge global variation in this. It's still very much, I think, part of this picture of this creature is human and so is entitled to be treated this way, or it's desperately wrong to treat this do certain things to this body because that's a human body. I don't think it would be appropriate to try to embed any of that at the kind of global level, but you would get this kind of local variance where they say, look, within our community, you can't do that to a body, or you must do that to a body, because that's what we think it means to be human.
Okay, so again, just to reiterate, on your view, human rights sort of arise out of this complex social human practice. So they're, which is another way of just saying that they are socially constructed. Now, I think there's a tendency for people to think that if something's socially constructed, then it's not, in some important sense, real. And so it doesn't really matter. But on your view, human rights, even though they're socially constructed, generate powerful moral obligations which require that we recognize and protect them. This, as you note, is one of the real challenges for a defender of human rights who takes the institutional approach. So how does this work, right? How can human rights be both socially constructed and deeply morally important?
Another big question and another difficult question.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. I should flag, I suppose, that I've got a story to tell here. I've written it down. It's part of the book. It feels still like a bit of a work in progress. I'm still thinking these things through. I think it's a lot easier to explain, I think, or justify the idea that social kinds or socially constructed things are real and morally significant than it is to do the full justification of my own theory. Because I think we can look at things like race and gender, right, which I think are increasingly accepted that these are social constructs. And they're wildly important, morally significant, right? There's a reason why people laugh at the politicians who say, I don't see colour, right? It's like, but racial categories are real. They have concrete effects on people's lives. And we ought to take that into consideration in thinking about how to act, right? So the socially constructed stuff can be incredibly morally significant, and I think it's not difficult. I mean, it's controversial in a lot of political contexts when you think about things like affirmative action to kind of justify the moral obligations that I think arise from things like gender and race. But at least within certain political circles, right, that's pretty taken for granted, right? We've constructed these social categories. They negatively impact people's lives. So, you know, we better make amends for that, or we better at least find some way of counteracting that or pushing back on that. So that, I think, the idea that social kinds aren't real, we can point to things like race and gender and say, look, they're real, they have concrete effects. Where my project gets a little bit difficult is that I want to say that the human's socially constructed, just like race and gender, but I want to say it's kind of like a good kind. Right. A lot of work on sex and gender, I'm sorry, on race and gender, like, look, these are really problematic categories. They negatively impact people's lives insofar as we have obligations with respect to them, that are kind of, in some sense, not treat people as if they're members of these categories. And when with a human, I'm kind of saying the reverse. So what's going on here? Part of my explanation for how these socially constructed categories can generate the kinds of moral obligations that I think human rights are is that even categories like race and gender aren't all bad, right? People come to really significantly identify with these social categories. It becomes part of our understanding of who we are. And we, I think, see that even in cases of race and gender, that people want to be seen as who they are a lot of the time, right? I mean, it's complicated, especially with gender. But the idea that we do some wrong to people by refusing to see them as the gender they are or as the race that they are, pretending that these categories don't exist, can be a real harm, I think, in terms of someone's understanding of themselves and their place in the world, right? We kind of navigate the world through these social categories. But I think right next door to that as well, there's this way in which, because these social categories do in fact exist and they do affect the way we treat one another, right? They're this kind of lens through which we all see one another as members of these social categories and hence as being entitled to certain forms of treatment, that one of the ways that I think people deliberately hurt one another, would be one way to put it, is to refuse to treat them in ways that members of the category ought to be treated. Yeah. It's a kind of signaling, I think, of disrespect, of rejection, of this isn't the right kind of person to be treated this way, right? It's picking someone out as deviant or as inferior. I'll give you a little example. I mean, it's a bit problematic because it's, you know, a bit elitist, but one example that I think can kind of help think about this. So think about the kind of significance, the symbolic significance of refusing to stand for a judge, right? Like, whatever, it doesn't hurt the judge in some sense, right? Like, and maybe we shouldn't have this norm anyway. But given that we do have this norm, it's a really clear way of signaling, like, I don't respect who you are, right? So when we have a norm that says respect is showed in these ways, it opens up a possibility of showing disrespect by refusing to do it. Same with things like titles like doctor. Like, I hate being called doctor. I really do. I think it's a joke.
It's because I wasn't sure whether I should refer to you as doctor.
No, oh God, don't. I'm really informal. I much prefer first names. I think that's great. I think we should do away with all this hierarchy. But
I'm with you.
But when you have that student who calls you miss and calls the male professors doctor, and when you say, but I'm a doctor, and they do it anyway, right, this is, whether deliberate or otherwise, right, it's signaling something socially about your status. Mm-hmm. And it's a, even though I don't believe in the status, right, the being refused it has this kind of symbolic effect of saying, and publicly, right, saying, right, you're not worthy, right, you're not.
And so it signals to everyone else that it would be permissible for them to treat you in that way as well.
Yeah. So I think it's got these kind of subjective kind of harms that happen when we fail to treat someone as in some sense the kind of person that they are, that it kind of messes with our self-understanding and it kind of makes us feel kind of unworthy. So there's this subjective stuff, but then there's this social positioning stuff, right? That it's refusing to treat someone a certain way, refusing to extend these kind of norms of respect that have built up around these social categories, is a way of, like, picking someone out, right, and lowering them in the eyes of their peers. And that's why I think that's where I think the moral juice comes from, mm-hmm. to get from membership in a social category to these obligations. And when we're thinking about a category like the human, right, to say to someone you're not that, you don't belong in that category, is one of the, I think, the most profound ways we can signal disrespect for someone, one of the most profound ways we can pick someone out, point to them, and in a sense signal to all our peers the rules don't hold for that one.
And as you said, the rules are sort of bare minimum rules for treatment. So yeah. You're signaling, you know, to other people that this person is not worthy of that kind of bare minimum of moral treatment. And that's really dangerous, it seems like.
Yeah. And I think this gives us a way of thinking about dehumanization, right? What is dehumanization? What's going on in dehumanization? On my view, it's a kind of excommunication, right? The human is, in some sense, a socially constructed category. It's a political category. And we can expel people from it. And that's one of the worst things, I think, we can do to someone. And I think these acts of dehumanization are, in a sense, attempts at excommunication, attempts to kind of get the group to kick that one out, which, again, I think is there's lots of other harms that are involved in things that are usually we call dehumanization, right? Physical pain is bad.
Right,
there are lots of reasons you're not inflict physical pain. Torture is bad for all sorts of reasons. But there's this kind of additional reason that it's this kind of symbolic, but not trivial because it's symbolic, but deeply symbolic kind of picking someone out as unworthy.
Yeah, and this is just anecdotal, but when you read of accounts of torturers and people who are holding other people captive, it seems like those people who are doing the torturing or doing the imprisoning are very much sensitive to this. And it's not merely, you know, as you said, if they're torturing, they're not merely trying to cause pain to get information or whatever it is they're trying to do. They tend to sort of go this extra mile to really make it clear to the person and to other people that you are, as you sort of said, excommunicated.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's this kind of, and it's hard. I think that psychologically, my sense is that it's hard for torturers to get into this place. So once they get there, it seems surprisingly easy to stay there. Yeah. But you've got to work to see someone as not human, but we can kind of do it. And this kind of tight connection between seeing someone as human and seeing the rules as applying to them, right? Once you can get yourself to not see them as a member of this group, as having this kind of status, right, then it kind of falls, the rest of it seems to fall apart pretty quickly and easily.
The term I should have used is degradation, right? There's really explicit attempts to degrade above and beyond inflicting pain or whatever else.
Yeah. And I think some of those kind of practices, we can also see them, and this comes back to the kind of the publicity side of things, like picking someone out and pointing to them as not being a member of this group, as not having this status. Some of the kind of forms of degradation seem kind of, in some sense, almost designed to make it harder for everyone else to see that person as human too, right? So you present someone as kind of fallen beneath the human as a way of trying to push them out.
I actually think that was a super compelling description of how you can go from social construction of human rights into why that can still be incredibly morally powerful and valuable. Okay, so one of the problems you identified for the variants of the orthodox view earlier was that it runs into this sort of tension between explanation and exclusion and an effort to explain how some capacity or property can ground these powerful moral claims. Theorists will end up appealing to some property or capacity that not everyone has. And so you exclude seemingly important members of the human community who we tend to think do and should have human rights. So how does your view get around that?
So basically on my view, to put it bluntly, it's up to us who counts as human, right? There's a biological category, but we in a sense have decided, not necessarily consciously or explicitly, but we've decided that that's sufficient to get you into this other kind of social class of what I'm also calling the human, confusingly. And because people with cognitive disabilities are members of the species, they just get in, right? So on my view, it's in some sense easy, right? Because we just made this decision, the boundaries of the social class are where we've put them, and we've put them there. That's a bit of a kind of glib answer though, right? Because it's up to us, it could also be up to us to revise. And we can revise in either direction. And I think one place we see this is in debates over the status of a fetus, right? On my view, if in a sense, the people who say that the fetus is a human get the kind of political upper hand. They can make it the case that fetuses are humans with all what that carries with it. But also the category could end up being restricted. And I think on my view, I was saying before that the part of what how I understand dehumanization is as a form of excommunication. And this excommunication on my approach is possible. It's a kind of looming danger in our world. So it is conceivable on my approach that the people with severe cognitive disabilities could end up excluded, but so could other categories of people too. And I think if we look around the world today, I would point to people, particularly the refugees and internally displaced peoples, as kind of, in a sense, falling through the cracks of human rights practice and hence being in danger of kind of slipping out of this social category. So people are, there is no kind of security on my kind of approach.
Yeah, it's a sort of explicitly risky kind of approach. It's good because it's flexible, so we can expand the conception, but things could go the other way, as you're saying. Which I guess leads us to an obvious question, which is someone might wonder, so what should guide us? What grounds do we have for saying that some direction or another is better if this is just all sort of up for grabs?
Yeah, so I kind of take a broadly consequentialist view here, right? Because there is no such thing as getting it right in the metaphysical sense, right? Like, it's not like there's a category out there that we need to get we need to find rules that map onto that, right? So we're creating this thing. It's not like we can sit down and make the rules and then it's going to happen, right? When we're talking about social category, there's a lot more messy and it's not under our direct control. But in some sense, some broad sense, it's up to us. And here I think we just have to try to imagine what would the world look like, right, if we change the boundaries. What's likely to happen? And I think when we think about things like cognitive disability, we have some pretty strong historical evidence about what happens when people don't get considered as fully human. We know what gets done to them. We've seen what gets done to them, which is why I think these kind of philosophical orthodox approaches that say, oh, well, you know, they don't have human rights, but don't worry, there's other reasons to treat them well. Like, we know what happens, right, when this kind of rhetorical move of they're not fully one of us takes hold. So I think we can look at the kind of predictable effects of excluding classes of human beings. And I think the evidence is strong enough, I think, that there's really no good reason, there couldn't be a good reason to exclude any kind of member of the species Homo sapien, except perhaps fetuses, right? Because I think here we want to look at what would happen, right, if fetuses got included. Mm. And as a woman, I think the consequences of that would be pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And so there, it's not like I think that, well, you know, if it's up to us, why don't we just let everything in, right? I mean, I don't think that's necessarily going to work. But I do think that for kind of living, I suppose, members of the species, it's a kind of no-brainer that if we take this kind of consequentialist approach, we should all get in. That does leave the question of should we expand to at least some non-human animals? And I find that a really difficult question. Here, I think, you know, the only thing that kind of, I think, pushes against that kind of inclusion is maybe too much of a thinning out of the meaning of the human and the kind of norms that attach to it, that we maybe get something special by we can kind of improve the way we the norms we have for how we treat one another by keeping it a little bit more contained. That's obviously a really dangerous argument. It's been used before with lots of other kinds of categories like man and white, and you know, the kind of gender and race categories use that very same argument. I'm painfully aware of that and nervous about extending it. But I think there's one kind of example I kind of keep coming back to in my mind to think, but maybe we can kind of justify holding the kind of line a little bit with the human, not necessarily not extending it at all into non-human animals, but not extending it to all living creatures, which is the analogy with something like kinship, which, having spoken to a lot of anthropologists, is pretty clear, like, kinship is socially constructed. It's one of these ones like parent was like, okay, there's something biological in the background, but like really, it's socially constructed. And we can see that because different cultures draw the boundaries in wildly different ways, and also have very different norms about how kin ought to be treated. But it's really useful to have this category of kin, right? It seems really valuable to have this group that we pick out and say, you're special. I owe you special things because you're my brother, because you're my mother, because you're my aunt, right? I'll treat you better. I'll be there for you more. I don't think it necessarily follows from that that we have to treat non-kin worse, or that we have to fail to recognize the obligations we have to non-kin. But it'd be really sad to have a world without kin, without those kind of special relationships, at least I think. And so when I'm feeling optimistic about, okay, we can justify drawing the boundaries roughly around the species. It's not just race all over again, but right. with the animals. It is thinking about something like kin. But I'm an optimist by nature, and I recognize the kind of pessimistic kind of response, which might be a much more realistic response, which is like we're just not good at having these categories of elevating certain classes without denigrating those who are excluded. And that's in a sense the bit of my theory that keeps me up at night the most, of like, am I trying to justify something that ends up justifying the slaughter of non-human animals? Like, I don't want to be that person. But I do think that, like, we've got something really valuable with human rights. It makes the world a much better place. I don't want to lose that. And it's that question of how do we hold on to it without...
It's difficult because it sounds like you have to account for the very kind of quirky and strange and bad psychology of human beings, right? Because, you know, one might just say, like, well, look, why do you need to extend human rights to animals? You can give them other kinds of really valuable rights, like sophisticated non-human animal rights. Right. But then you worry, I take it the worry is that even if in writing, if that looks really good and it were meant to guarantee, you know, strong protections and things like that, it just doesn't have the same force as calling something a human right. And then it also seems to set up this kind of hierarchy of human and then these, you know, close to human in some way, but not quite human rights.
And then we have to worry that
people... For whatever reason, humans just struggle with this sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think it kind of comes down to the question of can we have difference without hierarchy? Right. And it's really difficult. But I mean, here again, I kind of, it's going to go out on a limb and assume my family's never going to listen to this. Here, I think an analogy with kinship can be helpful, right? Because, like, I owe my, you know, I feel like I ought to do things for my family that I don't have to do to anyone else. I certainly don't think my family's superior, right? Morally superior, like more morally worthy. They matter more to me, but, like, and sure, maybe in a lifeboat situation, I choose my brother over, I don't know, some Nobel Prize winner or something. I think that's okay. But I don't think it has to set up this, there's this worry that if we take the human to be special, we're setting up this kind of cosmic hierarchy and we're placing humans at the top. And I think it's at least conceivable, and thinking again about kinship and like family and stuff, that we can take categories of classes of people or of individuals to be special without taking them to be better. That's my hope anyway. This can we have difference without hierarchy?
The force of the can is the really tricky thing, right? Surely it's psychologically conceivable, it's sociologically conceivable.
But we're talking, it's a consequentialist kind of argument, right. And we've got to think about what's plausible and predictable, not just what's possible. Right. So yes, there is that worry. Definitely.
Okay, so before we wrap up here, I just wanted to ask you one kind of big picture question, kind of in the ballpark of what we were just talking about. So earlier on, I said that I think work on the foundations of human rights is actually really important because it can help answer the skeptic who questions what reason we have to think that we actually have these human rights that all of a sudden people are talking about a lot, and et cetera, and that they can provide legitimate grounds for moral claims. But we also have the opposite concern, the activist concern, if you will, which is, what's the value of spending so much time and energy on providing a foundation for human rights? Right? How is that actually going to help us protect people, which is our aim, right? The philosopher Richard Rorty, who, as you know and you cite, made just this kind of argument, pointing out that the kind of rational persuasion that philosophers are trying to engage in just doesn't seem to change people's minds very well. In fact, he suggests we should instead be focusing our energies on what he calls sentimental education. Basically, you know, teaching the kids human rights, instilling human rights values in them. And I have to say, right, this is an attitude which I ran up against when I taught human rights. Students wanted to know what the practical value is of worrying about foundations. And just as an aside, right, this is something I worry about with this podcast as well, right? Is there anything, do we actually do any good by focusing on the philosophical arguments with respect to political issues. So is there any practical value to doing the deep philosophical work, or can doing the work be justified on other grounds, or perhaps is it not justified? What's your take on this?
So I'm a big kind of believer in the division of labor. I think, thank God for activists. They should absolutely be out there making the world a better place every day, and they should not stop what they're doing to come and read my philosophy. Like, no, please don't. Just go out and do your thing. So I think we need activists, absolutely. And I don't think all activists need to know about the foundations or to think about the foundations, right? I don't think that's necessary. I do think it's important to have at least some people thinking about the foundations, though. And I guess that's a kind of tricky bit, right? It's like, okay, we can all agree that we shouldn't all be thinking about it, but should anyone be wasting their time? I mean, one thing, I guess, is that, again, coming back to the division of labor, I'm not a very good activist. I've tried that. I don't have skills in that area. I don't think I'd be doing the world any good by kind of adopting that role. So I think in some sense we should all find the area where we can do the best good that we can do given our particular strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and all the rest of it. So we shouldn't kind of force everyone into the kind of activism mold. And I also, I'm going to answer your question. One more kind of thing. I think I am a kind of believer in the Rortian sentimental education kind of project, because on my view, right, how we kind of, part of how we sustain human rights is by sustaining this category of the human and the meaning that we give to the human. And these are just, it's fragile, right? It's just social norms. It's just how we've kind of been taught to think about what humans are owed. So we better be doing that teaching, right? Yep. We better be instilling that in our children, that there are ways that humans ought to be treated, right? So I think that all of that needs to be done. But I do think that we also need to be grappling with these big issues too. Part of it comes back to this answering the skeptic, right? We want to not just be kind of treading on thin air, right? We want to be able to, I think it's important when you confront those people who just say, it's all bullshit, right? It doesn't, you know, I'm a moral realist, they'll say, I don't think any of this stuff matters, and we should, it's all about power. And like, okay, we might not be able to convince that person, but that conversation often happens publicly. And I think when you get fence sitters, when you get people who are kind of tempted by that kind of the mischaracterization of Machiavelli, but Machiavellian kind of picture, right? We want to be able to talk them back off the ledge. And I think having a kind of range, I think, of good explanations, right? Look, we might not know the truth, but like, here's all these different ways in which it might be true, right? All of them are kind of viable. Think about them. Encouraging people in that direction, I think is helpful. That a kind of cynicism towards all of this, I think, is really dangerous. And so guarding against that cynicism, I think, is something that this philosophical work can do. But I also think that at some point, practice needs theory. I think, you know, it's not like practitioners of human rights never have to ask the question, which human rights do we have or who has human rights? They don't ask it every day. Like, most of the work can happen without asking these questions, but these questions will come up. And they need somewhere to go, right, to try to answer those questions. It comes up in the law all the time as well, right, in both domestic law and human rights law, about how do we actually interpret some of this stuff. And foundations can give us a way of interpreting it, give us some tools to do that interpretive work. So yeah, I think practice can meet the philosophical work, not every day, but at least sometimes. And when it's called on, it needs to be there, right? Because I think that's part of how the cynicism can kind of grow, is if we need an answer, we look for the answer, and there's just nothing there.
I had things to say that were basically completely in agreement with that, but you said it way better than I could, so I won't even add it. And I'll just thank you so much for your time, Susie, for being with us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at the Badlands Pod. Thanks again for listening.